It is 8:04 and you're listening to KBOO Radio. That's community radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Wednesday morning talk radio. I'm your host this morning, Lisa Loving. And today we're asking, have you ever lied, cheated, or even stole to help somebody else? Our guest, Lisa Dodson, she's the author of The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Lisa, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Lisa is going to be speaking in Portland Sunday, September 26th, from 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. at the, where are you going to be?
Oh, goodness.
Oh, the First Unitarian Church of Portland. I see
you. That's right.
Lisa, how did you come to write this book? What made you realize what's going on?
Well, the research for this book started out talking with low-income parents. And initially what I was doing was interviewing people to ask them how they were managing to take care of their families and get by when they were paid what are very low wages. About a third of all our working people make wages that are just insufficient for taking care of a family. So my research really started out talking with them and trying to find out how they managed. And in the course of doing that, I also decided to interview people who have a really close-up view of low-wage America, and that included employers and supervisors and teachers and nurses, people who work with low-income families. And in the course of interviewing these other people, these what I call middle-income people, about what they were seeing, I stumbled upon this phenomenon that some of them face moments when they simply can't go along with the rules because they think it's just so unfair, and so they bend or, in some cases, break the rules.
Mm. It makes me think of a time in this past year when I was sitting at my desk at work weeping, and my boss asked me why I was crying, and I told her, well, I'm going to write a whole bunch of checks this week for tests for my kids to get into college, and I know the checks are going to bounce. I know they're going to. I already know they're going to. And she said, well, I'm going to take care of that. And she went over to her corporate foundation, and she cut a check for how much it was going to be.
Wow.
And she sent it right to the testing organization. My kid got a full ride scholarship to college on behind those tests. And I know it's like I don't think that's cheating or bending the rules, but I have to say those college tests cost $90 each. Whatever. So we're throwing up in the phone lines because this is such a juicy topic. Have you, listeners, have you ever lied, cheated, or even stole to help somebody else, to help somebody out? Robin Hood people, 503-231-8187. Don't wait till last minute to call. Don't call everybody in the last 5 minutes of the show. We'd love to hear stories of if somebody has helped you out or if you've helped somebody else out. And if it's really sketchy, like the supervisor of a fast food pizza place who told Lisa that they pad their paychecks because you can't live on what they make. You don't have to identify yourself or where you work if it's something really sketchy. Because, you know, actually, Lisa, people can risk a lot by doing this, huh?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I should point out that most of the people who told me these stories were people who had struggled very hard ethically with the decisions that they were making. And they didn't make them in casually they didn't treat these as decisions that were a solution. What they were doing was they were in situations in which they were looking at the face of someone they work with every day, or teachers in school watching these kids come in every single day, knowing that their parents were doing the jobs of the nation, working hard, and were simply unable to protect them and keep them safe. And so if there was a rule, you know, rules are made with the idea that families can survive on their incomes. That's sort of at the heart of having a job. You know, we used to say to everybody, get a job. Well, these people all have jobs, and they're trying to take care of their kids, and they can't. And so there were these different moments, most of them not involving stealing, often involving changing paperwork, or doctors often talked about treating patients who didn't actually have the health insurance they needed, or teachers talked about, in some cases, not marking a child absent because that child had one more absence. She wouldn't be able to pass the grade because the child was home taking care of a younger child in the family because we don't provide child care for working parents. So there were all these different ways and moments in which a gesture like that would make a difference.
The number to call, we really want to throw this up to open to callers, 503-231-8187. Usually we talk a little bit more before we open the phone lines, but I want to hear people's stories. And also, I bet there's people out there that don't approve. I bet there are people listening right now that don't approve. I'd like to hear from you, too. 503-231-8187. Because, Lisa, when I hear you describe some of this stuff, I can just imagine what the powers that be would say, or even the sort of the other side of the argument would say, you know, passing kids through school without making them do the work is not, you know, you should just flunk them out because otherwise they're not going to be reading up to grade level or something like that. Or, again, this thing about padding the paycheck to help people be able to get by on how much they make. You know, I'm sure that the corporate office at Pizza Burger or whatever would say that that is stealing. And, you know, I can only imagine the people who get, I don't know, busted for this seems like the kind of thing where if someone does it and they get caught, it doesn't make it in the headlines because this whole issue doesn't really make it in the headlines.
Absolutely. Well, it's not an issue that has a lot of, you know, public attention at all. And, you know, I really want to emphasize that the people who did this, and I certainly, having now talked to hundreds of people, this is not the solution to the problem. And nobody who was engaged in these kinds of, I call them acts of economic disobedience, the people who were engaged in these kinds of acts, they weren't saying this is the solution to the problem. The solution to the problem, of course, is if people had a living wage and also if we made absolutely sure that there were services available, child care services, health care services, you know, in this incredibly wealthy nation, that we in fact have those services available so that people working hard have families that are safe and that are being protected. So no one put this out as a solution to the problem. In fact, I think that generally what I got from people was that breaking the rules is wrong. I mean, I certainly think that I live by rules, but sometimes there are much bigger wrongs than breaking a rule, and that seemed to be what some people were facing and made this kind of decision.
This is what the safety net looks like today.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Lisa Dodson. Her newest book, The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. She's going to be speaking this Sunday at the First Unitarian Church about her book, and it's going to be a talk on economic disobedience. I know some people out there listening right now engage in different kinds of economic disobedience. If you are engaging in economic disobedience, we would love to hear your story about what's going on with you and what it is that you do. 503-231-8187. Lisa, this goes to the heart of the inequities in our economic system. I mean, as I was just looking at it, I think it was yesterday, you know, our government bailed out these banks. They bailed out Chrysler. Mm-hmm. But what about the you know, there's stories, there's headlines in the Times every single day about poverty. And we just got the national poverty statistics out last week. Those were statistics from 2009. They're not even up to date, showing that, I guess I have to think about it. 1/7 of all the people in the United States are living under the poverty line, and something like 20% of all the children are living under the poverty line.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the issues that came up again and again in my research, and I finished my research before things were getting as bad as they are right now, But this has a disproportionate effect on children. Children are, in the U.S., the families that are most likely to be poor are families that have children and are raising children, and children themselves are most likely to be poor. The younger the child, the more likely the child is to be poor. And that issue really was part of what disturbed so many middle-income people. I mean, you were talking about, you know, the struggle you had and what you were facing trying to just make sure that your child could apply to colleges. I can tell you that that same moment that you were feeling is happening with millions and millions of families. Only what the mom's crying about is that she has to go to work and there's no one that she's leaving home to watch her child. Very, very often people are relying on children to watch other children because they can't pay for childcare. So it's a situation that's very quiet. It's endemic throughout the society, and these latest statistics, the census information, is just affirming what I was hearing in the stories of all of these different people, not only low-wage people, but also middle-income people who were seeing this and were saying, you know, I just can't, the old sort of myth, the image, well, these low-income people don't work hard enough or they're personally irresponsible, which is the line we often hear, that simply just doesn't hold up.
No, it doesn't. And this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. We are asking listeners, have you ever lied, cheated, or even stole to help somebody else who needs a hand? We'd love to hear from you. 503-231-8187. Joanne, I knew you were going to call, and I'd love to hear what you have to say about it.
I was even on a lot of programs thinking about not calling, but I decided to call for whatever psychological reason. You know, I think I've given up on the hope that people will really rise up in this country against all the crap that's been going on for too long. And I know I'll be called negative, which is not the truth. But I'm just going to say this because whatever I say is not going to change life for people. I'm going to say this. Lisa, darling, you got another juicy program, and thank you.
Thanks, Joanne. You know what's so interesting about what Joanne just brought up, and I think we maybe have another caller. The number to call, by the way, 503-231-8187. One of the things that strikes me about this whole idea of people rising up, or in this case of Lisa Dodson's book, The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy, there's kind of a blanket of comfort in a way over this country that makes us not see what's really going on. Even though we may know people that are losing their homes, their kids don't have, the kids are dropping out of school. There's just this, I don't know, it's like a Doctor Who style dissonance curtain, so that, you know, when I look at the newspaper or I look at the TV, most of what we're watching and most of what we're reading hides what's really going on. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I don't know if you wanted to respond to anything Joanne said, Lisa.
Well, you know, I'm sorry Joanne's feeling as negative as she is, and I'll tell you, in touring with this book and talking with people, I, of course, hear that kind of response. I seem to be, you know, one of those that are optimistic, and I guess I'm optimistic because I've had the opportunity to talk with and interview and listen to so many people. Unfortunately, their stories, their account, their concern about fairness is not what we're getting in the major media. You know, we get a kind of angry Tea Party-esque kind of narrative, or we simply hear, you know, we get the news about the poverty data, for example. But I'm really here to say that this is not an organized effort yet. Really powerful organized efforts always take a while to get together. But what I can say unequivocally is that lots and lots of people out there are very concerned about the unfairness. They don't believe that it's American. They don't believe it's an American way of life. And there are people who are very concerned, not only people who themselves are struggling with this, but there are a lot of people who feel as though their neighbors and their coworkers and others in the society, they're concerned about others as well. So I think that there is something very hopeful in this. It, of course, needs to be made much more public to kind of push back against some of Joanne's feelings of hopelessness.
Mm-hmm. The number to call, 503-231-8187. We're talking with Lisa Dodson. We're talking about The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. We do have a caller. We have Ross Doe on the phone. Ross, what's going on?
Yeah, I'm very interested in the topic that you're covering because I think all of us see some of this in the very difficult world that we're living in right now. And I wanted to mention that I've seen it quite a bit in higher education. Mm-hmm. We increasingly have students who one of the reasons they're going to school is to be because they can't get a job and they have no way to sustain themselves and they live off of their financial aid.
That's right.
Generally, our universities are sympathetic to these students, but I just wanted to mention one case in which, you know, sometimes we can't go as far as some students would like. We had a student who wanted to get into a master's degree program, but their undergraduate record was a C average, and they just didn't have the academic requirements for the program. And we found out later that the only reason the person wanted to get in the graduate program was because they didn't want their government checks to keep coming. And we were sad about that situation, but we just couldn't bend the rules quite enough for that particular case.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for calling in, Ross.
Yes, you're welcome.
And this number to call, talking about the moral underground, 503-231-8187. Have you ever lied, cheated, or even stole to help somebody else? Or conversely, are you working with any kind of a community project that gives people? I know that we've got the Fruit Tree Project in Portland. My friend Dingo and his sweetheart, Olive Root Beer, they work with garden gleaners. I wonder if anybody's out there helping people connect with housing or childcare who can't afford either of those things. And we do have a caller. Hey, it's Story. Story, what do you think about this issue?
Well, I'm curious to know if the author, whose name I don't have.
It's Lisa Dodson.
Hello, Dobson.
Dodson.
D-O-B.
With a D, as in da-da-da.
Yeah. Okay, Lisa, have you, so far the discussion has been about, it sounds like people's effort to level the playing field, so to speak. Mm. To make differences. And so far the discussion has addressed dire situations where people are penury, having trouble making day-to-day expenses. But is this impulse, do you have any evidence or have you established a control group or a reference by, let's say, addressing this in a nation which has many more social safety nets such as the Scandinavian countries? Does the impulse to so to speak level the playing field occur there? Is the incidence of it as frequent as it is, let's say, here where we have more dire circumstances, stances pinching people? Are you following me on that?
Yes, thanks for calling, Story. Thanks a lot.
Don't wait before you drop me. The point being is I'm thinking of Maslow's theory of hierarchy of needs and the idea that humans are aspiring animals. And that is the question. Let's say if we're in a much better endowed nation, that is, in terms of social safety nets, is the impulse among humans generally as frequent? Is the ratio of these gestures as frequent in, let's say, when it's not really a matter of...
We got you, Story. We got you. We're following you, okay? So
Bye.
I'd love to hear the answer. Thanks a
Bye.
Bunch for calling, because that's a really fascinating question. What do you think, Lisa? I mean, I'm not sure that you did, like, research across cultures or around the world or anything like that, but what's your take on that?
Well, I did not. There wasn't a comparison group. However, I guess the way I'd respond to that is that when I look at the nature of the kinds of acts of economic disobedience that people were engaging in, they were very much having to do with these kind of basic human needs, essential needs that families have and were unable to fulfill themselves in the way that in our society you're supposed to, i.e., you're supposed to work hard and take care of yourself. And so in the other countries that were being mentioned, there are all kinds of social programs that will intervene. And so a teacher at a school or a nurse at a health center or a manager at a business is not going to confront someone who is there on time working as hard as she can and knowing that at the end of the week he's going to hand over a paycheck to this parent, and there's absolutely no way that she's going to be able to feed her kids, provide them with a safe place to live. And this manager knows that because he too is raising children, and he knows how much it costs, and he knows how much she's being paid, you know, for a full-time job. So we actually have situations constantly. I mean, that's what I came upon. It is absolutely part of the society where people in the middle class are working with people who they recognize simply cannot get by in what they're making. And those are the moments. Those are the moments when they say, listen, I just can't go along with the rule. Common thing I heard when people said, I have to look myself in the mirror, or, you know, when I have to sleep at night. And I think that the meaning of that is, I feel like I become somebody I don't want to be. I feel complicit with what seems really unfair if I don't bend the rule. Now, I would say in the places that story, I believe the name of the caller mentioned, those are the Scandinavian countries, most of them. They simply don't put the rest of the society in that position of having to make that kind of choice, because they will intervene. The nation as a whole has programs which intervene and insist that families should not be treated that way.
And we do have two callers. The number to call, 503-231-8187. Our guest today is Lisa Dodson. Her book is The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. She's speaking on Sunday at the First Unitarian Church of Portland. She's giving a talk on economic disobedience, and that starts at 1 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church of Portland. And we've got Bob on the phone. Bob, what's your take?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. And what a brilliant book, Lisa. I wish I were in Portland. I'm living in my van in Las Vegas, Nevada. Found out yesterday that I'm just above the poverty line.
Yeah. Oh, aren't you the lucky one, Bob?
Yeah.
I swear.
Yeah, I live on Social Security, and I get $1,095 a month, mm-hmm. and I absolutely am brilliant with money, and there is no possible way I could rent an apartment.
No.
Anyway, as to the thing about civil disobedience,
yep.
In my opinion, and you kind of touched on it, I think we are all complicit with the system, but now that the system is falling apart and it's becoming really, really obvious that we're all going to be in the same boat, I think one of the best things that we can do to fight the problem is to eat local food, buy local products, and stay away from the corporate giants who are laughing at us. And they have made statements that without them, we cannot survive. I'm going to hang up and take your answer.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Thanks for calling. What do you think, Lisa?
Well, first I just want to say I'm really sorry that Bob's facing the situation that he is facing. Again, in taking this book around and going out and talking with people to collect information for it, this idea, the idea that you should really use local resources and in a sense pull away from dependence on the large corporations, this came up with quite a number of people throughout the places that I have gone, and I think that it is it's a really important point to bring forward.
And we do have another caller. The number to call is 503-231-8187. Have you ever lied, cheated, or even stole to help somebody else? We're talking about economic disobedience. Diane Fiasca?
It's actually Michelle Fiasca.
Michelle, great. Michelle, I'm talking and hearing at the same time. What's going on, Michelle?
Well, I just wanted to say that I'm actually going to be on Stephanie Potter's Recovery Zone a little later this morning with a brand new concept that might be of assistance to somebody like Bob. It's called, we've named it Seniors Homing Together, and we've launched a nationwide database for seniors to go on and do a profile, if they already are a homeowner, to do a profile on their home and themselves, to be matched up with seniors that go on the website and fill out a profile on what they're looking for in a house, you know, with to home together with other seniors and the homeowners. So it's an affordable way for people to actually be able to live a really thriving, vibrant lifestyle by matching yourselves with people who have common interests or maybe varied skill sets, like maybe somebody likes to cook and somebody else likes to do home repair. You match yourself up that way, and then you can do an aging-in-place situation where if you ever did need a caregiver, people could go in cooperatively together. The government's not involved in it at all. People just take responsibility for themselves by matching themselves up on this website.
Michelle, where can we find out more about that?
It's called Seniors Homing Together, and I'll also be on Stephanie Potter's Recovery Zone this morning at 11 a.m. So
great. Well, thanks for calling in.
You bet.
Stephanie Potter is our KBOO compatriot who has done the Recovery Zone show for several years now. It's always, it's a positivity show, an activism show. So definitely you're always going to stay tuned to the Recovery Zone. And you know, any of these shows are podcast on the KBOO website. That's KBOO.FM. You go to our website, you go to our homepage, and you look in the right-hand corner, and then you, the right-hand column, and then you look all the way down on the page, and it'll tell you where the most recent podcasts are, and this show will be podcast there by the end of today, thanks to our magical engineering pixie, Steven, and his dog, Sky. And this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Our guest this morning is Lisa Dodson. Her newest book, The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. She's speaking in Portland on Sunday at the First Unitarian Church. Her talk is going to be a talk on economic disobedience. That's downtown on Southwest 12th Avenue at 1 p.m. on Sunday. You know what, Lisa, Bob had said, now that the system is falling apart, people are looking around for different alternatives. But in truth, I have to say, Lisa, our system never worked for everyone. And one of the things you touch on in your book is kind of the history of the Underground Railroad and other acts of civil disobedience to draw attention to the inequities and how poor people, underserved communities, are just left out.
That's right. Yeah, I think that we have a long and rich history in this country of people deciding that the rules have to change. And, you know, that doesn't happen in one kind of fell swoop. If you actually read the history of the Underground Railroad, if you read the history of the Fugitive Slave Act, for example, or if you read the history of child labor legislation, all of these efforts to really change profound injustice in the society were started initially by people who were, as individuals, became involved, and gradually that turned into more and more people, in many cases people who hadn't intended necessarily to become activists or to take any stand. These were personal gestures often, and eventually those became how the whole society understood the injustice, and change came about. And I guess I, as I say, when I started my research, I was primarily focusing on the lives of low-income parents, mostly low-income mothers. This is work I've been doing for many, many years. And it was only through reaching out and listening to other kind of key informants, people who have a very close view of what's going on day to day, and hearing them talk about how concerned they were, how unfair what they were seeing, how unfair it seemed to them. There was actually a moment in the book when I was interviewing an employer, and he was a supervisor of low-wage workers, and I had been interviewing him just to get his perspective on the problems they were having keeping their jobs and managing their families. And he actually stopped me late in the interview, and he said to me, "Aren't you going to ask what this does to me?" And that was a moment when it became very clear to me that alongside this, the story, the account of what's happening to families that are working hard but are living poor, that there's this other account, and that is all the other people who see it, and in fact, some of them are very disturbed by it. And it's just not a public story. We don't hear much about it. And I think it's just very important for it to become, alongside some of the other kind of popular accounts now of Americans, the Tea Party account, for example, I think it's really important for us to remember that there are lots of us who are very concerned about fairness, and that includes economic fairness.
You are listening to Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. The number to call is 503-231-8187. And speaking of people who make a statement regarding civil rights without even realizing that they're going to do it, I was just speaking to one of the authors of a book called Becoming Jimi Hendrix. In 1962, Jimi Hendrix, before he was called Jimi Hendrix, actually sat in at a lunch counter in the South and got beat up and arrested. Fascinating. It's on everybody's plate. Anyway, we have Sue on the phone. Jane, I'm sorry, we've got Jane on the phone. Jane, what do you think?
Well, as I listen, my mind starts to divide this whole topic into a lot of different categories, and I wanted to just maybe draw some attention to the different categories because we've kind of lumped it into a big thing. It's the people who are like, say, padding their paychecks, or the individual who's benefiting, and the person in authority who is like not recording that day of absence at school, you know. So there's the person who's helping, and the person who is benefiting from these breaking of the rules. Now, in a society that values rules, and we look at societies that have no rules, and we realize that rules do have a purpose, and we come to those kind of dilemmas frequently. And I think the main thing for me to try to remember is justice should always be tempered with mercy. So I have been in a position in several of my jobs where I needed to, you know, wrestle with this kind of ethic. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, I made decisions regarding, like, okay, if this is something that needs attention by everybody, I should, as the person who's having the responsibility here, do it obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But there are other situations. I mean, that's because you do need the rule changed. Mm-hmm. That there are other situations in which these are minor things, and you really can't, you know, play with the rules too much, like a certain number of absences, the example that you brought up earlier. Yeah. I had the number of absences, examples, because I was a teacher at one time, of things where you have to make a very individual decision. You really aren't interested in changing the rule, but you have a responsibility to yourself and that other person that's very, very large. And I think the ethical situation there is to tell no one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All
you
right.
Absolutely tell no one. You don't tell the person you're helping, so they don't have the burden. And you don't tell your colleague, you don't tell your friends, because you're taking the total responsibility of breaking that rule on your own soul. And that then is, you say, okay, if this is an ethical problem, if I have messed up, it's all my mistake and not somebody else's.
What an interesting point Jane is making there, Lisa. She's actually, you know, digging right into the ethical dilemma of it, which you have been doing also. Thanks a lot for calling, Jane. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. And I wanted to bring up something else about that. But first, we've got another caller. We've got Shirley on the line. Shirley, what's your take on it?
Well, I've just been listening, and I think one thing that bothers me with the emphasis on the individual response to all this is that it kind of diverts away from the fact the whole system needs to change and takes energy away from that. All the talk about individual responsibility and personal response is important, of course, but in addition to that, the whole structure has to change, because individuals helping each other in an individual way, kind of like a church bake sale or something kind of thing, in a way, you know, a lot of people get lost. It has to be for everyone, and so the whole structure has to change. And the more we focus on individual, local kinds of things and think that's going to make it okay, that we divert our energy away from changing the whole system, and I think that's really important. That's all.
Thanks a lot, Shirley. Mm-hmm. Lisa, I mean, that's one of the things that's interested me, too, in this discussion. I mean, you're a union activist, you're an activist, a writer, a researcher. What is the next step? What's the missing piece here?
Well, first let me just say, I thought a lot of those comments are really interesting and kind of wrestling with when you take a stand publicly and when you take a stand quietly. I should say that most of the people who I interviewed had not made the decision that they were joining some kind of broad effort. Interesting element of how people discuss their actions was that almost everybody thought that they were the only one doing it. Mm. And that's part of what happens when acts or decisions such as these are kept quiet or kept hidden. So I think that the point that's being raised here, when do individual gestures of these kinds need to be made public, and how can they be turned into something that is broader? Because ultimately, this is not the solution. The solution is not all kinds of scattered individual hidden gestures. We're not going to change some of the inequity that people are so concerned about that way. But I do think it's often how things start. I think that it does start with, and I think that it's also, for me personally, it was tremendously hopeful how often I ran into this, because it reminded me how many people in our country actually care about issues of inequality and issues of fairness. So I agree with the argument that eventually, that the next stage is one in which these need to be joined together. They need to be linked, and they need to be made public. And people need to make their own decisions as to when they can speak up, because everyone is concerned about risks to themselves as well. These are decisions people have to make. But ultimately, of course, it has to become a public discussion, and it has to be part of a broader effort in order to make a change that really serves everyone and isn't just this sort of individual moment when perhaps somebody is willing to bend a rule for you.
And this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, hear a special interview with writer and teacher Richard Heinberg, author of Peak Everything, The Party's Over, and Blackout, about our need to address the depletion of natural resources now. At 10, hear Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein speaks with reporter John Gibler about the continued murder of journalists in Mexico. We'll also hear an excerpt from Oliver Stone's new documentary, South of the Border. At 11 on The Recovery Zone, Stephanie Potter hosts Michelle Fiasca, co-founder of Seniors Homing Together. She just called in to this show a few minutes ago. A website designed to help independent seniors who are seeking a home-like setting. And at 11, guest Diane Igaki, botanical artist and consultant for nonprofit organizations, discusses her work on cultural diplomacy in Eastern Tibet. Here this morning on Wednesday Morning Talk Radio, our guest is Lisa Dodson. Her newest book is The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Lisa is speaking in Portland on Sunday at 1 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church of Portland. She's going to be talking on economic disobedience, and she starts talking at 1 p.m. That's at the First Unitarian Church of Portland at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. How easy is that to remember? Anyway, Lisa, one of the things that gets me about this discussion, this is election season, it's the midterm elections. A lot of governorships around the country are up for grabs. So are a lot of seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. And people are looking at how they're wondering about what the Republican Party is going to do with the Tea Party movement, which seems to be splitting their votes. And it, to me, when I look at that whole thing that's going on in the Republican Party, it looks like it's a class-based division. And so you have these long-term, I'm just going to say fat cats. Not that I don't like some really pudgy cats and you cuddle the cats. I love cats. But you look at these institutionalized affluent people, basically, that are primarily our national elected officials. And then you have the Christine O'Donnells in, I think it's Virginia, who are, you know, she's missed her mortgage payments. She's had these different kinds of issues with, you know, she doesn't have enough of an income. But people are throwing their support around her, and the GOP is holding its nose over there and helping her with her campaign. So I just wonder, you know, if you're an activist, you're a union organizer, and author, and we all think that we're all left wingers. But when I look at the people that I meet in the Tea Party, I've got some reservations about racial issues there. But I think sometimes I think we've got more in common than we have in opposition. If we could overcome all of our racial issues, that would be a revolution. But anyway, what do you think about this really throbbing split in the right wing in this country?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that I wanted to say about this is that in the course of doing all of these interviews that I have done over the years, I met people who expressed tremendous concern about the split in the country, and primarily the economic split in the country. You know, how many hardworking people are simply unable to take care of their families and to get by. And now, of course, so many people who are losing jobs as well, or who have lost them, and are losing whatever economic stability that they had. And I think that this was expressed to me as the kind of key issue people were concerned about. And I have to tell you that, however, some of the people who I talked with who were very concerned about this and who were willing to actually, you know, engage in acts of economic disobedience and sort of take a stand with other people, I could see some of those people, in fact, seeing no other alternative than the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what's out there, and it does really seem as though there are people, part of the expression of that is a tremendous concern about how many people have been left behind. And I think that one of the things that's absolutely critical is that there be an alternative, that regular people, ordinary people, which are the people, those are the people that with whom I was speaking throughout the years, that there be an alternative that actually builds alliances between people, as so many people who I spoke with, that is exactly what they were trying to do in their own little way, in their own sort of corner of the world, that if there was an alternative that really talked in terms of building alliances as opposed to attacking certain groups, for instance, immigrants or other groups. I actually think that there would be a great drawing away from the sort of Tea Party organizing and that those tendencies. I think there would be a drawing away toward a much more positive and much more a kind of building kinship, which is really the opposite of what they've been doing.
You know, again, sometimes when I look, especially at these more recent poverty reports, and I look at these issues, you are the you were the director of the Division of Women's Health for the state of Massachusetts mm-hmm. before becoming a professor of sociology at Boston yeah. College. Here in Oregon, there's almost no women's clinics in the whole entire flipping state, except on the yeah. western side of it. And when you look at, I mean, our country, it is falling apart in a way that maybe, I mean, I feel like we're going back to a level that we were at maybe 100 years ago in some ways. Mm-hmm. And, which goes back to what Vegas Bob says. I hope he doesn't get upset that I call him Vegas Bob. I love the idea of Bob in a trailer in Vegas. I just think I love Bob. But again, I feel as though what the way we consume media, the way we watch TV, Sarah Palin is so shiny. You know, it's almost like we live in the Matrix, and we believe that we're all dressed in shiny leather clothes and we look really good and svelte, but actually we're sort of in a cave. And I sometimes I feel really stuck. I meet about how to drag the rest of the country into an understanding of just how screwed up we really are so that we can get on the same page and change the system as Jane and Shirley talked about changing the system. I mean, I don't know if one thing that I did want to ask you is when you did all this research, was there anything that surprised you about it?
Well, I think that the first, and ultimately it was it had a tremendous effect on where I went with this book. You know, I wasn't intending to write a book about economic disobedience. I didn't know to look for what I eventually called a moral underground. I was doing what sociologists and people who do the kind of ethnographic or in-person research, I was doing what we do, and that is I was going out and collecting lots and lots of accounts. And so in a sense, what surprised me most was when I came upon this phenomenon that there are a lot of people who at the time, and this was between 2001 and 2008, there were a lot of people who at that time were themselves earning enough to take care of their families, and yet they still objected. And even objected, a small group, not everybody by any means. Most people felt it was unfair, but a small group of people in the middle class were not only found it objectionable, but they were actually willing to take a risk. You know, they tried to keep it hidden, as we've already discussed. And I thought that was really an important part of what's going on in this country when there are so many people who are hurting so much economically. So I guess the first and biggest surprise was that spirit, a spirit that I think is some of our best American history, spirit of civil disobedience, was really expressing itself now as a kind of economic disobedience. And people were willing to take sides with other people.
And we do have a caller. Marlene is on the phone. What's your take, Marlene?
Well, I wanted to ask Lisa if she could speak a little bit to the demographics of the book, and I was also wondering if the book will be sold on Sunday.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. The book will be sold. That's the easy one. And as far as the demographics go, the research that went into this book, there were five different studies. They took place over about a 7-year period, and they took place in a lot of research I did in New England, some in New York City, some in two western states, in Wisconsin, and both cities, largely in cities, although some a little bit more rural in Maine, and it really represented a cross-section of Americans. The research took place in schools and also in workplaces and in connected to health centers or health facilities, hospitals. And so it was a broad cross-section of people who are low-income, doing the jobs, pretty typical lower wage jobs in this country, and then people who work with them on a day-to-day basis in those kind of social locations I just described.
All right, and we are asking people, have you ever lied, cheated, or even stole to help somebody else? Or has anybody ever done that to help you? We want to hear from you, 503-231-8187. Or do you have a strong opinion about this idea of economic disobedience? We would love to hear your take on it. We still have about 10 minutes left in this show. 503-231-8187. Lisa, I have to ask you about your previous book, Don't Call Us Out of Name. It's ringing a bell, but I can't remember what it was about.
Well, I did research previous to this book. I was doing research during the period of welfare reform, and I was very interested in hearing how low-income families, in particular single mother families, were dealing with no longer being able to take time out of the workplace in order to respond to needs that they had in their families. Low income families turn to public assistance in order to kind of pull out of the workforce for periods when they had needs. And I wanted to find out what was going on with these families at the point that they no longer could do that. And they were joining, you know, millions of other low-income parents. And so that was what that book was about. It was really, I wanted to tell what I felt were the untold lives of particularly single moms facing these issues. And, you know, the thread that came out of that book took me precisely into this other wave of research. They really are connected.
And the number to call, 503-231-8187. If someone did give us one last call, I'm sure we could squeeze you in if you felt like calling. 503-231-8187. Lisa, I'm really curious what you're working on for your next project. I bet you're already working on something else.
I am. The theme that really emerged from all of this research was how much the issue of families being unable to take time out to take care of members who need it, first and foremost children, but then other members of the family, elderly or disabled people or people who just need care. I've been very interested in how important that is, how that becomes central, and how almost everybody responded when I asked them questions. It was also the issue that led to most of this economic disobedience. It was those moments when, you know, it's interesting when you were speaking, you recalled that moment when you couldn't do what you felt like you really needed to do for your daughter. I often find that that's what middle-income people really sort of step over that line is when they look at a family, they look at a situation somebody's facing with an elderly person or someone who's ill or just a child in a family, and they imagine being in her shoes or his shoes. Mm-hmm. And it's really at that point, that kind of alliance and that sense that we're a society now that doesn't allow us to take care of the people, you know, that we have a fundamental responsibility to take care of, and also who we love most in the world, that in this society we're no longer able to do that. That seemed to be the real pivotal issue. And so I'm really following that thread now, going out again and doing research on that issue.
Great. And we do have two callers. We have Gordon on the line. Gordon, what's going on?
Well, I find your topic fascinating. Thank you so much, Lisa, for having such interesting programs. I'm a first-time caller. I'm old enough to remember when the number of farmers in the United States was up to 30% of the population. Mm-hmm. I think what we're talking about today is having suburbia discoursing some of the flaws in suburbia that we didn't have when I was growing up. If we didn't grow it and can it, we didn't eat it that winter.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And we were thinking ahead, and everybody kicked in, because if you wanted corn, you had to plant it and grow it and harvest it. And if you wanted tomato soup or whatever else you made it at home. And you were like the ant. You were industrious, and you made sure if you didn't want to eat, then you went hungry.
Mm. All right. Okay, Gordon, thanks a lot for calling. That's an interesting topic for another show. And we do have one last caller. Jeff is on the line. Jeff, what's going on?
Hello. My question is a simple, straightforward one, and that is, did she categorize the structures of disobedience in the book?
Okay, thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you.
I feel like, did Jane bring the same issue up? I'm not sure. What do you think, Lisa? Did you break it down into
different categories?
Yeah.
Well, I think Jane was talking more about sort of what should be private and what should be public. You know, when do you speak up? I'm not sure what the caller's, Jeff's interest in terms of categorizing. But let me just respond this way. You know, I found that some people were willing to go pretty far in what I see as kind of bending the rules. They felt that the rules were, you know, rules were fine, but when people were in the very vulnerable economic situation, so many people were in, particularly vis-a-vis their children, there were a lot of desire to bend the rules, a kind of looking the other way. And then there was a smaller category of people who were really willing to break the rules, outright break them. And the smallest among those were people who were willing to do, such as pad paychecks or actually collect groceries. Someone working in a grocery store, he just felt that it was wrong that people should be working all week long, handling food, and then go home with a paycheck, which was really made it impossible for them to feed their families. So he was finding ways of gathering some of those groceries, the food, and sending it home with them. Those were the least, that was the least frequent of the kinds of responses. But they were there. And so I, to the degree I categorized them, I really looked at how people were willing to kind of bend the rules and or look the other way. way and allow people a lot of flexibility that in fact the institution did not permit. And then there were people who actually took these kind of affirmative steps. They actually decided they were going to consciously engage in these acts of economic disobedience. So that was sort of the arc that I saw of this.
It's a Robin Hood effect. Well, Lisa, I just want to thank you for being with us. It's time for us to wrap up this show. Lisa Dodson, her book, The Moral Underground. She's going to be speaking in Portland this Sunday at 1 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church of Portland. She's talking on economic disobedience, and that's at the First Unitarian Church on Sunday at 1 p.m., and that's located at 1011 Southwest 12th in downtown Portland. Thank you so much for being with us, Lisa.
Thank you for having me, Lisa.
And this has been Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. Stay tuned for Richard Heinberg talking about need to address the depletion of natural resources now. Thanks for tuning in.